From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is The Exchange. Our pets are our friends, and caring for them can be expensive. Some estimates put the cost of the first year of owning your pet at more than $1,000. And when you go to the veterinarian, you have a lot to consider. And so do the veterinarians who are trying to care for your pets, pay their own bills, and stay mentally and physically well themselves. In this hour, we will talk to veterinarians who will tell us what's going on behind the scenes. They will clear up some common misconceptions and help us understand what it really means to own and care for our furry friends, or not so furry friends. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That is all one word. And joining me this hour is Sabrina Estabrook Russett. She is a general practitioner and veterinarian at Court Street Veterinary Hospital in Keene. Michael Dutton, a veterinarian at Ware Animal Hospital. And David Stowe, chief of staff of Fisherville Animal Hospital in Concord, former president of the New Hampshire Veterinary Medical Association. He's also an outgoing member of the State Board of Veterinary Medicine. Everybody, thank you very much for being here.
Good morning.
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 So this is going to be a robust conversation. Again, listeners, if you want to call in with your questions or comments about your veterinary experience, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Want to just get down to basics to start off, and we'll start with you, Sabrina, about a typical day for a veterinarian. When does your day start, and what does it start with?
Well, I think one of the things I really enjoy about this career is how multifaceted it is. So, you know, we have to start off mornings with typically consults in my practice. What that means is that we're seeing pets for regular wellness visits. We hope the vast majority of people walking in the door are having happy, healthy pets. They're updating HeartGuard, doing their annual blood tests for screening, vaccines. The very next appointment over could be a completely different species, hedgehogs, guinea pigs, small creepy crawlies. That's not just dogs and cats. And then, of course, we have our medical cases as well. So, you know, sick kiddos that are coming in that need more extensive diagnostics, occasionally hospitalization. And then as GPs, we also are tasked with, routine surgeries. So spays, neuters, we do a lot of emergency care in my practice as well. So it's not something that has to go to extensive referral hospitals. I think a lot of GPs are coming out and are really well versed on more extensive surgical techniques. So splenectomies and removing lumps and bumps and, all sorts of different life-saving procedures are offered at a GP level now.
Mm-hmm. And is this an 8-hour day for you where you just see one patient after another? Is that how it goes?
One patient after another, but almost never an 8-hour day.
Okay. How many hours then?
Easily 10, sometimes 12.
Wow.
Our primary care is, primary responsibilities to our patients. I recently did a career day talk over at Keene Middle School, and some of the kids were very concerned about how long we were there and why don't we go home right at 5 or 6 o'clock. But if we have sick patients, then, that's where our hearts lie with you and our responsibility, especially being a country practitioner. We've got more of a limited availability to kick something over to a 24-hour facility where they've got nurses and staff on all day. So we stay late and we fix and we heal.
A 24-hour facility, that would be more for emergency visits, yes?
Exactly.
Okay. And same question for you, Michael. What about your day? Is it similar to what Sabrina was saying?
Oh, yeah, very similar. So my day appointments usually start at 8. We'll do maybe an hour of appointments. And then because I have quite a bit of exotic work, as I'm usually into surgery, fixing all the non-dog cats out there.
So exotic, unpack that a little bit. What do you mean by exotic?
Reptiles, birds, ferrets, rabbits, and so forth.
Okay.
And so I do a fair amount of general practitioner work on it, but I'm also an exotic specialist. So I'm the one who gets all the referrals on the things that are maybe outside what a typical general practitioner is comfortable with handling. Usually break for lunch, and then I'm usually there until 6 or 7:30 at night.
So like Sabrina, it's a 10, 12-hour day routinely.
Long day.
It's a long day. And so, David, your chief of staff, is that similar to what you're seeing?
I would say the schedule's very similar, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so is that Is that a concern for you? I mean, you mentioned it was a concern for the middle school kids you spoke to, but is it a concern among the industry that these hours are quite long and perhaps that might be difficult for veterinarians to cope with?
I think on a personal level, it's not something that concerns me. I went into this with the expectation that this is a career. It's not ever going to be a 9-to-5 for me. You know, I worked in different industries prior to vet med and had the 9-to-5. It wasn't something that I felt I was required to have in order to have a fulfilling life. But I think as an industry, it is something that we have some concerns with just in terms of mental health, you know, burnout, compassion fatigue. And I think sometimes we see these kind of opinions contributing to the corporatization of our field as well, where you have corporates that do close at, you know, 5-6 o'clock at night. So there's a huge spectrum of availability in terms of what you want in your personal career as a vet, what's available for working hours and expectations going into it.
And just as a practical consideration, are your days filled with people who make appointments in advance, or are there slots in your day where you can handle a walk-in so that someone doesn't have to go to a 24-hour facility? Michael?
It depends on how the schedule works. I would want to say for me, about 2/3 of my appointment schedule is already filled in the morning, and then the other third is changes dynamically. And it's a case of I can't make it, I have to go do this and whatnot, and so it drops out. We do a fair number of double books, which is we try to squeeze in you with your sick cat or whatnot at a time that maybe it's a healthy pet exam and we're able to sort of squeeze it in.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned mental health, so we might as well jump into that part of this because it is a fact of life for many veterinarians. I wanted to throw some statistics out from the CDC. They did a survey, here are some of those numbers. 1.1% of males and 1.4% of females in the veterinary profession have attempted suicide since leaving veterinary school. The report goes on to say, this is below the national average for suicide attempts, and the authors suggest it may be due to veterinarians' ready access to drugs used in lethal suicide attempts, so they are more likely to die by suicide, thus there are fewer survivors to respond to the survey. That's according to the CDC. They also found that about 1/4 of males and more than 1/3 of females in veterinary medicine have experienced depressive episodes since leaving veterinary school, which is about 1.5 times the prevalence of U.S. adults throughout their lifetime. So I'll ask you, Michael, what do you make of those figures?
I think they're totally legitimate. You know, we mentor a lot of students going into vet college, and I think the vet schools are being very proactive on handling the mental well-being of their candidates. But, you know, we deal with death. I looked up statistics. As last year, my Ware Animal Hospital did 13,000 visits. We euthanized about 650 pets. Now, the good news is that most of them were, you know, age-related, cancer, you know, I think very appropriate reasons to euthanize pets. But we deal with killing things on a daily basis. And most of us didn't get into veterinary medicine to euthanize animals, it's to save animals. So that's an issue. The other thing I see with new students is a student debt load is truly crushing. The average starting salary for a small animal private practitioner is about $67,000. But the student debt load, depending on the survey, it's $156,000 to $183,000. I mean, these guys are paying probably close to $1,000 to $2,000 a month in student loan payments. And so you work long hours, you deal with a lot of depressing type of activities, and you have a big monetary stress on it. It's not a great trio of things.
Yeah. Sabrina?
I agree with all of that. You know, I think your statistics are a little bit different than ones that I'm familiar with. I had recently read that we're at 3-4 times of a higher risk of suicide than general population. And I think what Mike's talking about in terms of contributing factors is incredibly accurate. You know, I'm of this younger generation of vets that's coming out of university right now. I think 150 to 180,000 is probably grossly underrated in terms of what we're taking out in student loan debt. Just anecdotally, most of my peers, my colleagues, are sitting between 200,000 to 400,000. And you're right. We make, you know, not enough money to cover those loans sometimes. So it's a really complicated factor in terms of what can we offer, what can we heal, external stresses. And then I think, you know, leaving university in this, you know, really supportive team environment and everybody's working together on cases. And then you come into, you know, a GP world oftentimes as a single solo practitioner or, you know, one to two other vets in the practice. If you don't have a really solid team, that can be really isolating as well.
So, yeah. So, David, I want you to weigh in on this as well. It seems like debt and death as part of the job can be very difficult for veterinarians.
It is. And I think, you know, veterinarians are very passionate about their work. I think people are motivated to go to veterinary medicine because they love their work, and they come out with these staggering debts. And, you know, no one even wants to hear what their starting salary is going to be, and they all just sort of all repress that. And they come out, and the reality strikes. The workday is long. Again, they're passionate about their work. And clients' expectations are high. So clients put a lot of pressure on veterinarians, too, I think, financially. So here we are trying to save animals, but clients often can't afford the care. So it's a really tough position for them to be in.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're talking with three people with a lot of experience when it comes to caring for pets, both common and exotic. What questions do you have about veterinary care? What experience have you had at a veterinary hospital that has changed your idea of what it means to own a pet? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And just a note about another show that we're planning on doing about large animal veterinary medicine. We're not going to focus on large animals today, but we do want people with experiences with large animal veterinary medicine to send us an email if you have questions. You will help us put together that show for later. Again, the email address, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to the phones and talk to Diane in Manchester. Diane, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment is I totally sympathize with the monetary stress that vets go through. I think everyone who graduates from college these days is having the same kind of stress. I sympathize with that. But I, as a person with disabilities in a wheelchair, also have my fair share of budgetary stresses. And when this happens everywhere, not just at veterinary offices, but to request, say, a installation of a bumper transition to get over thresholds, or to ask to be given a script to take to Walmart to pay $4 versus $30. I have found that I've been judged for these kinds of things before, and I understand from my research that that's a big part of the business is the medication, but I also want to be a responsible owner and make sure I meet all of my obligations and keep my pet healthy and happy, and so I don't want to be judged or treated different from other people because I make these requests after doing my research.
Okay, Diane, well, go ahead.
I also wanted to just ask why there's not more information for potential owners about the influx of dogs from the South and the different issues they're bringing to New Hampshire and the impact that that's having in our state.
Okay, Diane. Well, thank you very much for your comment. Sabrina, a couple points that Diane brought up. You indicated you wanted to respond to one of them.
Sure. I think, you know, I guess to start with, I would apologize that you ever felt that you were judged by a person in our profession. I think that's not what we set out to do. If you look at it from an animal perspective, then a lot of where we come from as vets is establishing the welfare and health of animals that are in our care. And sometimes in pursuit of that and trying to be a pet's best advocate, we can lose sight of the human factor in all of this as well. Personally, I come from some of a family that's, you know, a low socioeconomic status, so I kind of have a more wide-ranging perspective on cost and limitations. And I think one of the things I would encourage you to do is to continue, searching for a vet that has those same kind of values that you do. The expectation that everybody's going to have an MRI or CT scan isn't realistic, and so I think we do the best that we can with limitations, financial or otherwise, that are in front of us, and keep trying and see how we can heal and treat this pet.
Michael.
From a financial point of view, is the pharmacy is a cost center. I own a business, own a couple. And for my current business, it's about 13%. Now, where's that 13% go to? It goes to keep other things less expensive, vaccines, exams, and so forth. So as part of the total mix, yes, it's a double-digit number, but it's not a high double-digit number. In terms of the Southern dogs, I grew up in Maine. I went to college at Michigan State and came back and worked in New Hampshire. And for years and years and years, I didn't see all the parasites that they saw down south. And now that we have all these Southern dogs, I've had to take a crash course in, all the other worms they can get. Other than that, I think the Southern dogs are well-meaning. The folks do great. I think most of the folks that come in know what they're getting into and so forth. I just see a higher parasite load. And like I said, a couple hours of intense reading, we got up to date on that pretty quick.
And would that higher parasite load present a threat to native dogs, we'll say, native to New Hampshire dogs?
Not so much for that, because each dog is relatively isolated into their own yard. The bigger issue we run into is some of these worms are contagious to people. Hmm. And so they're called zoonotic diseases. And our concern is that your child gets hookworm or roundworm, and those can be really, really nasty diseases. So we recommend worming a lot more frequently than we did 25 years ago.
So maybe a lot more care required for dogs rescued from the South as opposed to dogs bred here or even rescued here.
Yes, a lot more vigilance, that's for sure.
Okay, great. And David?
And one of the challenges we have with these dogs is that they're not always brought in the way they're supposed to be brought in. Any dog coming into New Hampshire from the South is supposed to be brought into a New Hampshire facility, quarantined for 48 hours, and receive a health certificate from a veterinary licensed in New Hampshire. And this doesn't always happen. If those safeguards are followed, if it's a reputable transporter, the likelihood of encountering these problems is relatively low. But unfortunately, some of our neighboring states don't have the restrictions or the rules that we have. And so sometimes these dogs are brought in through Vermont or Maine, and that's when we run into more problems.
So we are speaking with Sabrina Estabrook-Russett, general practitioner and veterinarian at Court Street Veterinary Hospital in Keene, Michael Dutton, veterinarian at Ware Animal Hospital, and David Stowe, chief of staff of Fisherville Animal Hospital in Concord, former president of the New Hampshire Veterinary Medical Association. He's also outgoing member of the State Board of Veterinary Medicine. And with you, we want to hear your questions about veterinary medicine. We're going to get more into questions of cost, especially when it comes down to the wire, when you really have to make a decision about what to do about your pet's care, possibly at the end of your pet's life. We'll talk more about expectations people have for their veterinary care and other questions that you have, whatever's on your mind. We're happy to talk about it here on The Exchange. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We will be right back. Thank you.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Now, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we are speaking with veterinarian Sabrina Estabrook-Russett, Michael Dutton, and David Stowe here, three people with a broad range of experience caring for pets. What questions do you have? What experiences have you had at a veterinary hospital that has changed your idea of what it means to own a pet? We are steering away from comments about large animal veterinary medicine today. We won't be asking our panelists to diagnose your pet over the phone either, but all other questions are fair game. So call us now. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You could also email your questions or comments, exchange@nhpr.org. I want to ask you all about something. If you've been to the veterinarian recently, you may have been handed a pamphlet on health insurance plans for veterinary for your pet. So we'll start with you, Michael, about these plans. Would you recommend them? Do they work just like health insurance plans for humans?
Yes, there are a variety of health insurance companies. They do all have to be approved by the New Hampshire Board of Insurance. So some that are in other states don't meet the capital requirements to work in New Hampshire. And most of them are a major medical with a healthy pet rider. Depending on the program, it can be $39 to $79 a month. And about 2% of my clients have them. They love them.
2%? That's really low.
It is. The UK, I think, is at 50%. I think California is at 7 or 8%. I believe I read somewhere like Denmark's at 90%, but about 2% of our clients have it, and they love it. Right now, it's working well for us. Most of the times how it works is the owner pays us and then they get reimbursed. And so our paperwork is pretty low and pretty low impact on staffing.
And Sabrina?
I qualified from school over in Scotland at the University of Edinburgh, so I can speak to UK's insurance rates. And as a practitioner over there, even in final year vet school, it really ameliorates some of these issues that we see as vets and as owners coming in. If you're in a catastrophic injury state, if you need to be at the emergency vet overnight, and we have huge concerns about cost of care and what that means for our clients, then having pet insurance can take all of those compounding factors away from it. The answer can be just do what you need to do to fix him. And then we're not facing things like convenience euthanasia or ripping families apart if we're talking about, you know, surrendering animals and whether or not that's the right thing to do. So I'm a huge fan. I think it's definitely worth it.
Convenience euthanasia, that sounds like a terrifying euphemism to me.
And I think there's a lot of complicating factors to that. But sometimes we are faced with a pet that has a treatable condition that's actively suffering from it, something, you know, an acute injury, a fracture or a hit by car, something like that. And we know medically we can heal this pet. We could get over this one hump of an injury. But if we're faced with, you know, restrictive financial concerns that make this insurmountable, then sometimes we have families that can't afford an $800, you know, $1,500 repair. And that's real life sometimes. But what we can afford is budgeting for $30 to $70 a month for the pet insurance plan. And I think, you know, talking with the last caller that we had on the phone on disability, really strict financial concerns there, that might be something that we can budget for and make sure that we're covering at least in terms of injury or significant illnesses, end-of-life care. And it can really take the pressure off of both parties.
When you say cover it, you mean the veterinary hospital covering the cost of the surgery or whatever is needed? Is that what you're saying?
Or the insurance covering.
The insurance covering it.
Yes.
Okay. Because if you don't have insurance and suddenly you're hit with an $800 or $1,000 bill, what happens? Is the only option to euthanize the pet?
Not necessarily. And I think a lot of practices, and again, I'm not a business owner, so maybe Mike can speak towards this a little bit more. We have a really hard time offering things like payment plans or, you know, we've got Care Credit, which is a credit line that you can take out to try to finance some of these things. But really in the heat of the moment, you know, if we're in one of these acute injuries, then we're up against it and we've got to make decisions. And, you know, the financing is something that really, really contributes to our, we were just talking about our mental health and our concerns for your pet. It definitely goes both ways. So,
David?
And so I have a little bit of concern about health insurance for pets. I mean, we saw what happened in the human medical field in the United States when insurances started to pay the way. And there was a certain amount of pressure on doctors to perform tests because maybe it was indicated. I mean, right now when we have an owner bring a pet into us, we have to come up with a treatment plan, a diagnostic plan based on what is really indicated. Remove the financial constraints, and there may be a tendency to perform more tests than are necessary, which in the end is going to drive up the cost of care and drive up the cost of insurance. So it's kind of a slippery slope. I mean, I wish all my clients came in or were able to afford the treatment their pet needs. But again, I'm a little bit concerned about this.
Mm-hmm. One practice that I've heard of with respect to someone not being able to afford necessary care for a pet is to surrender the pet to the animal hospital. Is that common?
No, I would say it's not common, and that also concerns me. I mean, I hate to separate the client from their pet. You know, really our job is to try to do everything we can to keep the pet in the home. But again, the reality is that sometimes people can't afford the care.
Listeners, if you've got questions about veterinary care, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to the phones and talk to Annie in Litchfield. Annie, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Good morning. I want to talk about the state's position on titter testing and how, with what the current regulations are, the average responsible pet owner can't use that particular option. What's your position, and do you think this is going to change?
And Annie, thank you very much for your call. And let's go to Michael for this one.
So what Annie's discussing is a titer test. And so when you vaccinate an animal, a human, whatever, is that you produce antibodies to the vaccine, which will mimic the natural infection. And currently, New Hampshire only requires a rabies vaccine, and most of the schedules are one the first year, and then after that, it can go on to a three-year schedule depending on the vaccine that your veterinarian uses. And so from a state point of view, as you're asking for a rabies vaccine every 3 years, there is a titer test. It's actually more expensive than the vaccine. And the thing with a titer test, it tells you whether you're protected right now at this moment as opposed to a predictive value for the next year, 2 years, or 3 years. Currently, and Dave can probably chime in on this, is that the state follows the United States Compendium on Rabies, which prefers to have them vaccinated as opposed to a titer test. Is that correct, David?
Yeah, the state refers or defers to the specialist in the area. I mean, the other thing I'll mention is that veterinarians are vaccinated or were vaccinated for rabies. And I used to dutifully go in every 2 years and have my titer drawn to check for that. And along about 2008, my physician said, "We're not doing that anymore." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because the titers are meaningless." And there I was, you know, I have my hands in the mouths of animals all the time, occasionally bitten by animals. And all of a sudden, my physician is telling me that there is no test to determine whether or not I'm protected from rabies. So the reality is that the titers aren't a meaningful way to assess whether or not we're protected from a disease.
Listeners, thank you very much for your calls. If you've got more, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We've got Brenna on the line from Portsmouth. Brenna, thanks very much for calling.
Hi. I don't know if I'm muted.
You are not. You are on the air.
Okay. Sorry. I have all kinds of puppies and dogs here. My question was for the vets. And first, I want to say thank you. I know your job is difficult. I've had to put more of my own pets down than I would like. And I know it's probably the worst part of your day. So I appreciate all the hard work that you guys do. My question is, and I work for a large national nonprofit, so I see all this research go by my desk. And there's a lot of evidence that folks who are very, very low income love and care for their pets just as much as people with the kind of resources needed to pay for even diagnostic basic upkeep of pets. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on systemic changes that might help bring the cost of pet care to a place where those folks can get better access to it. And I know there are things like pet supply stores have shot clinics. Some shelters have rabies clinics or low-cost spay-neuter. And I didn't know if you had any thoughts on that sort of access for low-income folks.
Well, Brenna, thank you very much for the call. Let's put that to David Stowe.
Yeah, Brenna, that's a great question. And I wish there was a simple answer to this. As you know, if you work with nonprofits, there probably isn't. What's interesting is there's actually studies have been done that show there's an inverse relationship between affluence and attachment to pets. In other words, lower income people often have a greater attachment to their pets than higher income people. So, I mean, in an ideal world, there'd be a way to support this because the reality is a lot of low income people do not even access veterinary care because it's not, they don't have the resources. So I would love to have an answer. I'm not even sure if insurance will reach down to those folks. But I find, you know, as a practitioner who's been doing this for quite a while, that some of my favorite clients are the ones that come in their rust bucket Toyotas with the mufflers dragging on the ground because they love their dogs and cats. And very often the lady in the fur coat and the Mercedes is, it's another animal.
Along the lines of cost, we got an email from someone identifying only as a frustrated pet owner. And the email is, I own 3 dogs and 1 cat. My vet bills can be very costly, and I seem to be at the vet every 3 months because the vaccines are also staggered. My question is, are these vaccines truly necessary? I've done a lot of research, and I'm not sure how reliable it is, but I feel most of these vaccines aren't completely necessary, especially Lyme/Lepto. Also, my cat is older, has hypothyroidism, so it's over $100 every time I go because of the blood work. I'm spending a lot, and I'm just becoming frustrated with feeling like I have to do these vaccines or I'm a bad person. That's the comment from frustrated pet owner going to the vet every 3 months because of these staggered vaccines. Are they necessary? Sabrina.
I think one of the things that we should keep in mind when it comes to non-core vaccines, so specifically the leptospirosis and the Lyme disease vaccine, is as practitioners, we look at this as a cost of prevention versus treatment. Leptospirosis is a bacteria that's ubiquitous in the environment. It can be under puddles and in leaves and really can, number one, attack and kill kidneys and send your pets into renal failure if we have this on board. Number two, it's zoonotic, so it poses a public health risk. So anybody at home that's going to be contacting this pet's urine, that could be really dangerous for kids and especially immunocompromised people at home.
So zoonotic, that's a word that means it can go from pets to humans?
Yes, okay. Yep, exactly. In terms of Lyme vaccine, you know, it's not 100% effective. Nothing is. But what we end up recommending is preventative. So your NexGard or you know, flea and tick treatment every single month, plus the combination of Lyme disease, and that combo should protect your pet. You know, we've got, in terms of HeartGuard, heartworm prevention, you can buy 7 years' worth of HeartGuard for what it would cost to treat your pet for a single episode of heartworm disease, and he might not survive that kind of treatment. Mm. So
you're talking about ounce of prevention, pound of cure. Kind
exactly.
Of okay. Related question from Beth. Humans go to the doctor once per year by recommendation. Why do veterinarians want pets to go to the vet twice per year? First of all, I want to check that assumption. Is that true? Do veterinarians want people to bring in their pets twice a year?
For us, young pets will do once a year. Usually once they hit 8 to 10 years of age, we do recommend twice a year. And I think the best way to explain it is that, you know, we always say, well, you know, one dog year is 7 human years. Is once you get up to the older animal, and I've seen it numerous times, is that, gee, yeah, it was fine 6 months ago, but now it has some kidney dysfunction or it has a high thyroid. Especially in cats, there is a push to have twice a year recommendations. That's not something that I personally do, but it is out there. But I think on the older animal, every 6 months is very prudent. And again, it's an ounce of prevention is a pound of cure.
Sabrina?
I agree. I think humans, you're able to verbalize and go and talk to your doctor. And if you're not feeling well, then you can articulate that. Animals have a really limited set of tools to express discomfort to us. And, you know, as stupid humans, we frustratingly have really limited understanding of their nonverbal cues. So having them in and doing our exams and feeling lumps and bumps, all of that stuff really contributes to overall health and prevention, catching something when it's still treatable and it's not, you know, an acute injury and we're facing an emergency again.
Mm-hmm. And I've also heard, and correct me if this is not true, but at least for dogs, if they're feeling sick, they try to hide that because they don't want to seem they're evolved to want to not seem vulnerable to predators. So they do their best to hide when they're not feeling well. David, you're nodding. Is this something you've heard?
Yeah, it's true. And very hard. It's difficult for clients to appreciate that their animals are sick, especially cats, I think, because what do cats do? They sit around. They go to the litter box. They go to the feed bowl. Mm-hmm. And very often, you know, people bring cats into me and they've lost 1, 2, 3, 4 pounds. And owners thought, yeah, I thought it was getting a little bit thinner, but, you know, those are major, major red flags.
Yeah, that's a big weight loss for a cat.
It's huge.
Yeah. Let's go to Peggy in Center Harbor. Peggy, thanks very much for calling.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's your question or comment?
I just wanted to make a quick comment about earlier. There was a comment about a concern about dogs coming to New Hampshire from the south. That they would be somehow a danger to native New Hampshire dogs. My own personal experience, I adopted a dog from Georgia, from the New Hampshire Humane Society, and before she was a puppy, before she got adopted, the Humane Society took complete care of her. She got all her shots. She was dewormed. She was in perfect health when I took her home. And the reason she was brought here from Georgia was the whole litter of puppies was about to be put to sleep.
Well, Peggy, thank you very much for your comment.
We have no kill shelters here in New Hampshire, and that's a big reason why a lot of healthy dogs are brought up here, so they can be adopted instead of being put to sleep. So, and the Humane Society takes great care of them before they release them for adoption, so.
Yeah, Peggy, well, thank you very much. And I sort of want to echo Peggy's comments. My rescue dog, Drake, he came from Arkansas, from a kill shelter, brought up here and given the care that he needed. He had awful mange when he finally arrived, but we cared for him and he's back to health. So maybe it just depends on the owner and some TLC.
And it depends on whether, as Dave said, whether they're going through some sort of 48-hour channel and so forth. I mean, I have people who brought in dogs and you ask them where they got it. And truly, it was from the back of the van in a Walmart in Massachusetts.
Yikes. Yeah. Well, quick question before we go on to break. Are people generally surprised when they hear how much veterinary care costs, Sabrina?
I don't think so. I think, you know, the expectation for vet care has changed drastically over the past 20 years. You know, and as a younger vet that's coming out of it, we're versed on MRI and CT, and you know, we keep talking about these expensive procedures, but all of that comes with a cost. So referral centers and oncologists and what we're able to do now in vet medicine really can be comparable to what we have available in human medicine as well.
But I will add that we are very careful to give itemized bills when our clients go home.
Yes.
And maybe the problem is the physicians should be giving us a bill to take out of the office so we really understand what the cost of care is.
Understanding the cost of care is very, very important,
yes.
It seems, to everybody here. Okay. Well, this is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're talking with three very knowledgeable people about what it means to care for a pet. If you've got questions about veterinary care or a comment about what it's like to need a veterinarian services for your pet or pets, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll get to your phone calls and comments after the break. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we are speaking today about veterinary medicine. what it takes to be a veterinarian, what pet owners should know, and in this part of the show, we're going to be talking about how the state keeps an eye on those caring for animals in New Hampshire. Michael Dutton, Sabrina Estabrook-Russett, and David Stowe are here, and we're going to answer your questions as best we can in the last 20 minutes or so of the show. If you've got questions, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. So let's talk a little bit about oversight. David, you've got some insight to this. Some pet owners may not even ever heard of the State Board of Veterinary Medicine. So bare bones, what does this board do?
So our job is to basically serve the public. We are here for the citizens of New Hampshire to ensure that they don't have adverse events at the veterinary office. And when they do, they can file complaints, and those complaints are investigated.
And who does the investigating, the board?
Yeah, so the board is comprised of seven individuals. There's five practitioners from the state. There's a state veterinarian, and there's a member of the public who also sits on the board. So when a complaint comes in, we look at it and decide, first off, is there a cause for investigation? I would say most complaints at least start the investigative process. Some are dismissed. I mean, our biggest challenge is to discern, is the complaint, is it about a bad outcome? I mean, unfortunately, we are a very litigious society, and when something goes wrong, somebody has to be to blame. But the reality is that what we're trying to do is sort through, is this a bad outcome, or is this really bad medicine that was performed?
Okay, and at what point in the complaint process does this information about the complaint become public?
The outcome, the complaints are, so first of all, the complaint comes into the board. The full board reviews the complaints, and an investigator is assigned. The investigator, again, is a practicing veterinarian in New Hampshire. I mean, I think we have a great process in New Hampshire. In some states, investigations are performed by individuals who are not veterinarians. So in this state, veterinarians who have, you know, been in the trenches are investigating these complaints, and they look into them, they do research, they get the copy of the medical records, and a percentage of the complaints are dismissed without investigation, a small percentage. Some are dismissed with investigation. In some cases, at the end of the investigation, we send what we call a letter of concern to the practitioner. But the reality is that very, very, very few complaints rise to the level of public disclosure because, honestly, very few of the complaints are that serious.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm a pet owner looking for a vetting my vets, so to speak, and I want to make sure that I'm going to choose one that doesn't have a lot of complaints, is there a place I can go to find and see, oh, this veterinarian has a lot of problems, or this veterinarian has none at all? Is there a website or something that I could look at?
There is. The state, of course, again, it is a state website. But if you go and look up the Board of Veterinary Medicine, and when you way through the site, you'll find there's a license lookup. And if you look at the individual who's listed, all veterinarians are licensed by the state. And if you look up that individual, you'll see if there's ever any public admonishment in that case.
Okay. And since we mentioned this other organization in the show as well, the New Hampshire Veterinary Medical Association, how does that differ from the board we were just speaking about?
Yeah, the New Hampshire VMA is the little sister or little brother to the American Veterinary Medical Association, which is a national organization. The New Hampshire VMA is completely separate from the New Hampshire Board of Veterinary Medicine. And the New Hampshire VMA functions to serve the members in the state on a variety of topics.
Okay. Listeners, if you've got questions, the number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And let's talk to Julie in Exeter. Julie, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
It's a comment, actually. I'm the past president of the New Hampshire Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And the point that was made earlier is such a good one, that people who are on fixed or low incomes love their animals as much and maybe more than or at least as much as other people. At the SPCA, the New Hampshire SPCA, we piloted a program last year and we're continuing it now, where a fully equipped medical van, our veterinarian, vet techs, and some volunteers go out to low-income and senior housing and provide basic services for the animals there.
Well, Julie, thank you very much for your comments. And seems like you're describing an option for people who we were talking earlier about being surprised by a big bill. This may be one of several, or is this the only one we may have heard of? Michael, what do you think?
Well, a lot of low-cost vaccine clinics exist in a variety of spots in the state. Petco, PetSmart, numerous SPCAs, and so forth. This is the first time I've heard of the mobile van, but I know that's been done in other parts of the country, too. And like I said, we're a highly fragmented field. There are numerous ways to have all veterinary medicine. It's just the client's got to look through it and figure it out.
Okay. Let's talk about opioid medications, because this is obviously a problem throughout the state for people, and occasionally animals are prescribed some strong drugs. As far as I know, you do have to report to the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, right, Sabrina?
We do. And I would say that the distinction should be made that most of what we do in our jobs in terms of opioid use is in-house. So I wouldn't be scripting out something that could necessarily be abused. There's one exception to that, a drug that's an opioid that we can give orally and send home. But we're finding out we've got scientific research on top of research that says it's just not an adequate analgesic for animals anymore. So the fact that it doesn't work, compounded with our new reporting laws and the risk to human abuse, is, I think, as an industry, going to be moving us away from using that as a go-home to begin with. So I think, you know, the concern for in-house use isn't the same in vet med as it is in human med.
David?
Yeah, I agree. Veterinarians don't use many opioids. And most of them choose to prescribe them through pharmacies. So it's really not an issue. I mean, veterinarians are obligated by state law to participate in the prescription drug monitoring program. But the reality is that there's the incidence of drug diversion via veterinary channels is essentially non-existent.
Okay. And let's go to Jim in Nashua. Jim, thank you very much for calling.
Hi, yes. I wanted to bring up...
Jim, it seems like we're having trouble hearing from you. If you feel like you can, it seems like you're driving, send us an email. We'll see if we can get an answer for you. We've also got a question from Anne here who says, my cat loves to go outside. She loves to climb trees and run around in the yard. I've often been told that cats should not go outside. What's your opinion? Cats live long, happy lives outside, but maybe it's not safe. What are your thoughts, David?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, I wish cats could be outside too, but I also love birds. And the reality is that the cats kill millions and millions of birds every year. They're at greater risk of injury and illness going outside. But on the other hand, it's true that being outside is an enriching environment for cats. And one of the other realities we deal with is bored cats. Sitting around the house, sitting around the apartment is not a good life for a cat either. So that's tough.
Yeah, got some nods around the table for that particular one. We've got a lot of questions here, so I want to ask one from Professor Michael Magoon here. Question is, one of your guests stated there's an inverse relationship between affluence and attitude toward pet ownership. Michael asks, I was curious about the source of that research. David, I think you might have mentioned that earlier. Was there research to back that up?
There was, and I wish I can't recall the reference at this point. I'm sorry.
Okay. I want to ask you a broader question about veterinary medicine. Over the years, where is it headed? Is it diversifying into specialties? Sabrina, you're nodding at that particular point, but I don't know if you have a broader sense of where it's headed.
Well, I think in terms of specialization, absolutely.
Yeah.
When I was finishing up in school, we had a whole camp of my colleagues who never wanted to be just a GP. You know, they specifically wanted
general
to.
General practitioner.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, there's huge, very impressive residency programs, internships. There's a lot that's available in terms of not ever having to work up a single vomiting or diarrhea case in your entire life. So lots of fancy options moving forward.
Michael?
So when I graduated 1986, 11% of the graduating class did some post-graduation internship or residency. That number is now up to 44%, I believe. And so right now you could graduate from vet school and hang up your shingle. There's not an internship. There's not a residency requirement. So, you know, now you're saying 41 to 44% of veterinarians coming out of school want that extra training.
And David?
And that's another problem. I mean, I love the fact that we have more specialists available. When I first opened my practice in New Hampshire, there were 4 people with specialty experience, and now there's many. So we can provide higher level of care, but that's also going to add to the cost of care. So again, it's a double-edged sword.
That was my next question. What is the relationship between this, the way this is evolving in cost? It seems like the trend towards specialties is increasing the cost.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk to Stan in Nashua. Stan, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Just like to make a comment about Dr. Dutton. He's probably the only avian specialist in this and in New England. And he saved my parrot. And if anyone out there has a bird, please go to him.
Thank you.
So,
how much did you pay him, Mike?
Oh, do you remember this particular parrot?
Yes, actually. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. So if I'm a pet owner and I'm looking for the right veterinarian, what kinds of things might I start looking for? Like if I'm doing a Google search, like what would I put into that Google search?
Well, in the old days, you know, we had Yellow Page ads and Ask Your Neighbor. Now, you know, it's social media. We have our system. You come in with your pet. If we have your email, we ask you for a review. So I think more and more people are going straight to social media and looking up your rating. And they still may, you know, like with our parrot, they may still reach out to their own little group. But social media, I think, has supplanted Yellow Pages and talking to your neighbor.
Sabrina, agree?
I do agree. And I think I would say take that with a grain of salt. We work very, very hard in this industry to work with owners and treat and heal. And there's going to be instances where we just can't come to the table and see eye to eye. And I think one of the things as, you know, human doctors, opthals, dentists, all of us, we can't respond to these negative reviews online. And I think it's unfortunate because rather than working towards, you know, rectifying a situation or working something out with a client, then sometimes the knee-jerk reaction is to, you know, and go and have a social media storm. So there's some tough ones with that as well.
Yeah, that sounds really difficult. We got an email from Tracy who wrote in to talk about savings plans. She says, I love that my vet offers wellness plans. It's a monthly payment that covers the wellness services of my puppy's care and includes discounts on many other services my pet may need. Plans offer different payment levels, so plans can include services such as dental and surgeries. Much like insurance, it helps my budget that some services are already covered. And she goes on to say, I believe you can combine these things with an insurance plan as well. So I guess not an insurance plan, but kind of like an insurance plan?
Yeah, we looked at wellness plans a few years ago. It's tough being a single practice to logistically do the back office stuff because, you know, you're running the credit cards, if the credit card's expired and so forth. So we tried wellness plans and we found that they were just not working for us. Now, that being said, national organizations and especially the big corporate hospitals, VCA and Banfield, have them. And I do think they have a place. I think for the small, single, 2-3 doctor practice, there just has to be a better consolidation or a better program out there to make it financially work because most of our practices, you know, we're not making tons of money here because we have high overhead costs.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask about dental care because that's another part of healthcare that might be overlooked. How big a part of your job, maybe I'll start with you, Sabrina, is caring for your pet's teeth?
It's so important. I'm actually very, very passionate about dental care. I'm one of those odd vets that really enjoys doing it. And I think it's something that we have study after study saying that increased, dental plaque and disease in the mouth has a knock-on effect for your whole body. It's not just teeth. It's not just bad breath. It can lead to renal disease and liver pathology and, heart conditions as well. And even if we ignore all of that, it's so horrifically painful to have advanced dental disease in the mouths of our pets. And most of them will continue eating and hide the signs, and you'd never know it until you have the exam.
Hmm. Okay, David?
Yeah, I agree with Sabrina. Dental disease is hugely important. The challenge is trying to provide it at a reasonable cost again, because unfortunately we have yet to figure out how to get our cats and dogs to sit in the chair, open their mouth, and so we can work on their teeth. So it requires anesthesia. It requires radiography. I was the first veterinarian in the state to have dental radiography, and it gets expensive because, honestly, it often some of these complicated dentistries can take 2, 3, 4 hours sometimes. And so cost is high, but clearly the need for it is great.
Sabrina.
I would submit that, cost can be something that we work towards decreasing if you're coming in for routine dentals yearly. The cost comes along with dental surgery when we've got advanced dental disease and extractions that's needed. So if you're coming in and doing your yearly exams and we do a scale and polish and clean up teeth and they don't need extractions, then that's much more affordable.
We're coming up at the end of the show, but I just want to ask each of you briefly what you really want people in need of veterinary care for their pets to know before they walk through the door of the veterinary hospital. We'll start with you, Michael.
Start your veterinarian relationship now. You know, we talk about people coming in and they can't afford the procedure. If you're a new client and you're like, gee, can you put me on a payment plan? I'm less likely to say yes as opposed to, gee, I've been a client for 10 years. So start a relationship now.
David?
Yeah, I agree with Mike. Start a relationship with a veterinarian as soon as you get the pet. One of the problems with these dogs that come up from the South is very often they've been spayed, they've had all the vaccines. People think they don't need anything. Get them into a veterinarian, establish that relationship before you need the veterinarian at 10 o'clock at night.
And Sabrina?
I agree very much so.
Great. Well, that is Sabrina Estabrook-Russett, general practitioner and veterinarian at Court Street Veterinary Hospital in Keene. Michael Dutton is a veterinarian at Ware Animal Hospital. And David Stowe is a consultant and former president of the New Hampshire Veterinary Medical Association, also an outgoing member of the State Board of Veterinary Medicine. Thank you all very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Remember, the conversation does continue online at nhpr.org and on Facebook. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.